Key West hires a new city manager with a controversial past. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Key West new city manager served prison time for selling cocaine. What role do criminal records play for those who seek higher political office? Plus, are the leaders in the Keys from the Keys? And does it matter? Also, facial recognition technology is being used at airports, hotels, and casinos. It's part of everyday life, but there are concerns of bias. Can the technology accurately identify faces that are not white? We're going to talk with the CEO of a local facial recognition tech company. Finally, our coral reefs are in trouble, whether from bleaching or other diseases, but the truth is, what can we do to save them? We're going to meet the leader of the exploration group Ocean X. They're launching a campaign tracking the health of the reefs, and you can follow along. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Should a criminal record prevent someone from seeking higher office in government, city government, state government, anything? This question was top of mind during the City Commission in Key West last week as the commissioners approved a new city manager. Greg Valise has worked with the City of Key West since 2014. He was arrested for cocaine trafficking back in the early 90s. The Miami Herald's Gwen Filosa covered the commission meeting last week when Valise was approved, and she explains the controversy surrounding his past and the fact that a nationwide search was not conducted for the position. Gwen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Let's start by first describing, let's tell people, who is Greg Valise, Key West new city manager? Who is he?
Greg Valise is born and raised in Key West. He, for a time, owned a ceramic tile business, installing and selling tile. But he's actually worked for the City of Key West in some capacity since 2005. He's been assistant city manager since 2014, when he was promoted from director of community services. And he, very well-known family, he has five children that he's raised here, and everybody knows him.
And I mean, as the assistant city manager, what were some of his duties? What role does he play in that position?
You're doing a lot of hands-on work, is my understanding. Everything from, Key West is a small town, but it's run like a major city with all the tourism, and things like closing roads for festivals and dealing with traffic headaches and all kinds of organization of different departments.
So when he was in college, I mean, the story is that, right, when he was a student at Florida State University, that's when he was convicted for cocaine dealing with the intent to distribute, I think is what I'd read, and then his sentence was knocked down to 38 months. What was the story?
Yeah, the conviction dates back to, the indictment dates back to 1991. It's his only, it's the only criminal record he has, but it was a federal case, and he readily admits to what he did. He dealt cocaine with a group of guys, and he doesn't try to downplay this. Everybody knows about it, especially, locals, conks. That's what they call themselves, conks, if you're born and raised in Key West. But it's almost like people think it would be rude to bring it up. I mean, I did a separate story on it because I thought it was news noteworthy to say, look, he does have this criminal record, and there are lots of jobs where you can't, in the private sector, where that would might be held against you getting a job.
It was never brought up, or nobody said anything when he was entering into public life anyway.
He says it's come up in interviews and such, and that he's always had to explain it to people, but as far as publicly, they had a two-hour meeting that got a little exciting at some point, a little wild with the divisive comments and debate, and it never came up once.
So why did the city commission what did the city commission say about why they voted in favor of Valise?
Well, it was a 4-3 vote, a 7-member commission, and they're the people in charge of hiring the city manager. The city manager serves at their pleasure, and Commissioner Billy Wardlow, himself a conk, he's the one that put forth the proposal. Mr. Valise told me today he didn't ask for a resolution to be put on the agenda, that was just a straight up vote to give him the job. But he's always been very public about wanting it.
Yeah, he didn't apply. He wanted it, but he didn't apply for it. He didn't ask for it.
There was no formal application process, no.
And what did they say about his qualifications?
That's what was being bandied about by, I mean, so many major business owners and political figures, and all, many of them, many, not all, but many of them, conks, born and raised, and they have businesses here. They got up and said he was the most qualified person because he's been in city works for so long. And he's done a lot of different things with, you know, being the director of public works and community services, like parks and recs and streets and such, that it's no easy job. So you get to know everybody.
Again, I'm talking with Gwen Filosa. She covers the Keys for the Miami Herald and Florida Keys News. So the city of Key West has voted for a new city manager, but that city manager does have a record on his past. Should it matter? Obviously for them, the city commission voted and they gave him the job. There was another thing, Gwen, is that there was a push by some to do a national search. So where did that conversation go?
Well, obviously went nowhere. The mayor, Mary Terry Johnston, was very upset by the direct hiring of Mr. Velez. She said it wasn't personal. So did the other commissioners. They're saying it wasn't about him. It was about the way it looked. And she says to have a transparent, you know, process. Many locals got up and said the same thing, that no one criticized him publicly. They were just saying, why don't we have at least a local, regional Florida search, if not national? The last time they had a national search, it was kind of a disaster. The gentleman they hired only lasted about a year and a half, 2 years, and he was ousted by the commission, and he just didn't work out for this. That got brought up a lot.
Do you think that played a role in this one, in this time around?
I do. I think people were, especially advocates for Greg and people that supported him to get the job kept mentioning it and saying, look, this is what happens when we, and it's not, the city isn't the only public sector or private firm that's had trouble finding people from up north, so to speak, to that can last here.
Yeah. And that kind of goes to this other bigger idea of, you know, city politics in Key West and, you know, bringing in outsiders to run things. Do you think that plays a role? Do you think that there's that, you know, at least in the consciousness of city leaders and voters that, you know what, we want somebody who's been here a while instead of bringing in an outsider? Or does it matter?
I mean, it certainly came up tons during that commission meeting, right, you know, up to the moment that they voted on it. And the way this, there's so many locals who got up and spoke, and it was just so clear that there is this division between conks and between people and transplants, people that come down here. And, you know, sometimes people move here and want to make changes, and change is incredibly slow in Key West as far as changing the way things are, you know, the way they do business, so to speak. And it happens across the island, a very welcoming city. I mean, Key West has always been incredibly openly accepting of all walks of life, but there's a certain way that things have been done for, you know, decades here, and people really know each other. I mean, one of the commissioners said his Mr. Velez's grandmother used to babysit him as a child. I mean, they're the bloodlines run thick.
Yeah, and I wondered about that too, because it seems like it's like small town politics, and so there's an intimacy.
Very much so.
Yeah, and so I wondered though. I mean, do you how often do you see that? How often do you see it's the conks, the locals, or again, anybody who's been there at least a long time, and then of course people who've retired and they've just recently moved there, but as you said, they want to bring their ideas with them. How often does that happen? How often does that conflict happen between sides?
I wouldn't say it happens, you know, frequently, but when it comes to some major decisions, even when it's, you know, who to give the trash hauling contract to, or certain jobs, construction jobs, a lot of times people elected and not elected make a point of saying, you know, we want local firms to get this work.
And the other thing too, I wondered if, and because I don't go down there enough, but I wondered if you often see, or if you see even every once in a while, any kind of struggle for a change, perhaps a physical change in within the city, and locals are not for it. Does that happen as well?
Oh, do you mean development?
Yeah,
or
anything like that, yeah.
Yes, that becomes something where there's always a fight between what should architecture look like in new construction? What should it look like? And does it look, people always hear say, you know, oh, we're going to look like Boca, which I'm not sure why that's bad, but it's new, brand new because you're not the city code, the historical codes, you can't build like fake old stuff. And that becomes sometimes an issue. And public green space, like they just built a new giant waterfront park. And that was something that a lot of locals wanted for their families. They wanted something of their own.
You know, I mean, because the best comparison I have is like Sanibel, even though it's over on the west coast of Florida.
Yes.
But that, you know, they have such strict rules about like no streetlights, no buildings over three stories, no drive-throughs. And then you get new people to move in and they want to bring changes. And there's always a conflict. Small town politics, usually that's how you see it happen.
Especially in these destination retirement communities or places where, you know, and it takes a lot of money to come down here and build a home or buy a home. So there's certain people that say, I pay the bills, I pay the taxes, why can't I have this say too? And that becomes a big part of the argument.
Have you heard from, coming back to Mr. Velez, have you heard from readers? Have they said anything about this? Or again, do they just feel like, you know what, he's one of us, he's done a great job, we like him?
Well, I was reporting live on my Facebook page during the meeting, and my page just started blowing up with, again, the transplants and people that are new saying this was an awful way to choose a new city manager and that it should have been at least a local regional search. And calling it Bubba politics, which is a term. Bubba is a term of endearment in Key West, but sometimes it can be used by outsiders as, oh, it's a corrupt system or it's an unfair system of your birthright gives you certain jobs. And that did come up a lot. And some people got really heated. I had to take off a lot of comments at one point that were critical. They're a little overblown for a Facebook page.
Hey, listen, if anybody says local politics can be boring, you have no idea. Gwen,
correct.
Gwen Velosa again covers the Keys for the Miami Herald and Florida Keys News. Again, last week, Key West City Commission voted for their new city manager despite his history. They decided, you know what, he's the man for the job. Gwen, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
All right, still to come, facial recognition software. This isn't new, but a local company is developing what it hopes will be the future of tech that eliminates bias. That's coming up next on Sundial. Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, facial recognition technology is increasingly becoming a regular part of our daily lives. It's been implemented in hotels, casinos, and airlines. Police departments have been using it for years. Under a pilot program, the city of Orlando is working with Amazon to send images from city cameras to their facial recognition software in real time. There are a lot of concerns surrounding the tech, how law enforcement uses it, if it's racially biased, and how the data is collected. The House Committee on Oversight and Reform has the second of two meetings today about the use of facial recognition technology by government agencies. And there's a letter now signed by the ACLU and 60 other partners calling for a federal moratorium on the use of the tech by law enforcement. Kairos is a South Florida-based facial recognition technology company. Melissa Doval is Kairos' CEO, and she joins us now to talk about that. Melissa, thanks so much for the time.
Hi, Louis. Thanks for having me.
You know, there are people who will say this is fascinating technology. Others will say it is frightening. You are helping to bring this technology to another level. But can you feel both perspectives? Do you understand both perspectives about it?
Absolutely. And we're doing everything in our power to make sure that it is not frightening and that we're doing everything that we can to make sure that the software and that the technology helps individuals as much as possible and that it protects individuals as much as possible.
All right. So what exactly, I mean, as I said, it's not new, but how do you define facial recognition technology and how it works?
There's different aspects of facial recognition. You can do facial, what they call facial verification, which is a one-to-one match, which is what we specialize in, where if you were logging into an account, they would have your face on file and it would verify that you're the person logging into this account. And then you have facial recognition, which is a one-to-many verification. So if the system has a database of many faces and you're one of the faces that has access to a certain system, it would do a search of your face against that database. And then there's a detection, which is where the law enforcement argument comes in, which is you're scanning a crowd and you're detecting faces, and then you're taking those faces and running them against huge databases to see what you can possibly fish from there.
How good is the technology, though, right now?
So if you're running a one-to-one verification or one-to-many where you have a database, the technology is very, very good. It's for the most part almost 100% accurate. When it comes to detection, that's a bit different. And it depends on the quality of the photos that you're using. It depends on the camera angles that you're using. And so it's every use case and every scenario is very, very different.
Who are Kairos's customers? Who's using your technology right now?
Well, right now we've been working with a lot of different startups and technology companies who are looking to do proof of concepts with facial recognition in their apps, whether it's mobile or web. But as of late, with our self-hosted solution, we're really starting to see enterprise companies adopting the technology. And so you're starting to see casinos and hotels really looking into this more, not only as a security option, but also as a way to make a customer experience much better when they step onto the property.
I mean, I do remember, I recall, having lived in Las Vegas, how casinos are using this technology for a lot of different reasons. And then, of course, the hotels as well. I mentioned airlines. Right now, which companies are using it most, and where do you see that technology going next?
Well, I mean, you're starting to see the adoption of facial recognition all over the place. It's not which companies are using it most. It's more about which company is going to use it next, because we're getting queries from all different types of industries and all different types of companies. The mass adoption is going to start to really hit its maturity in the next 3 to 5 years. As far as what's coming next, we only have to look to our neighbors in China. And although they are a communist state and they do relinquish their rights to certain privacies, their entire country is monitored through facial recognition, and all of their financial transactions are done either through their cell phone or through facial recognition. So you're going to start to see some of that kind of leak over here into the United States.
And you know what, the other thing too, when you think about like the hotels, the casinos, and even our cell phones now in some cases, how much of that technology is something that I can opt into or I can choose not to?
I think that as the government starts to become more involved, and as we start to see regulation start to evolve when it comes to facial recognition, that's going to be the one determining factor in how companies and government agencies are going to be able to use facial recognition. You're going to have the opt-in feature. The problem is that most people aren't going to really read the fine print, and most people are going to end up opting in, and they're not going to realize that they're going to be monitored and that they're going to be facial recognition is going to be used whenever they're using that company's platform or that government's platform. But that's essentially how most companies and governments are going to get around using it.
Let's talk about some of the concerns.
Sure.
Bias and privacy. Let's talk about bias. Why does facial recognition technology often misidentify people of color compared to white counterpart, their white counterparts?
Sure. So facial recognition algorithms were created on white colleges by white men. And so the tendency to feed it white male data is very prevalent. And so just like you're training a puppy to do tricks, if you train it to sit, it will learn to sit. But if you don't train it to roll over, it won't learn to roll over. If you don't feed an algorithm pictures of black women or brown women, it won't learn to properly detect those women. And so in giving that example, the algorithm only learns what you teach it. And therefore it really doesn't perform very well, or in the past it hadn't performed very well
with black and brown faces.
So is it still white men who are setting these algorithms?
It's evolving. The technology is changing. The individuals who are participating in the development of this technology has shifted significantly. We're starting to see vast improvements in the technology and in the data that is being fed to the algorithms. And I think we're going to start to see a big shift in the results that we're getting from these models.
Can you tell me, give me an example of where that bias has popped up, where the technology was not able to read a face because maybe it was a brown or black face?
So the MIT Media Lab did a study on face detection. And so when it came to detecting faces of black women, it was not able to actually even identify the fact that there would detect that there was actually a face in the frame. And so that's an inherent problem in the actual software. And what we did identify was that the models that were used were older models. Once we start to test these newer models, we're starting to see that that isn't inherently the problem going forward. So we should start to see significant improvements with the newer models that are being released.
So wait a minute, you're telling me that the old models, you put a picture of a black woman in front of it, it couldn't even tell that there was a face there?
It couldn't.
What does it identify then?
It just didn't. It wouldn't be able to tell. So the technology works with pixelation. And so it wouldn't be able to, if there was a dark background, it wouldn't be able to be able to tell the difference between the dark pixelation of the face and the dark pixelation of the background.
So Kairos is supposed to be working on this diversity, on the issue of, you know, so how are you doing that? How are you retraining the algorithms? Or is it, again, just teaching a computer to be able to see all shades of humanity?
So we're taking a two-pronged approach. Our model is a bit bulkier because we need more computing power for it to be able to drill down into more pixels, right? So we're refining and retuning the model to look and dig down deeper, right? And then the data that we're feeding the model is more diverse. So ideally, it's costing us more money, but we're spending more money to go out and find properly labeled data and properly diverse data that we can feed the model and that we can get back better results.
And part of it, too, is hiring more people of color.
Correct.
And that's something that Kairos has been focused on. But just, you know, when you look across the entire industry, do you get the sense that's happening, though?
You know, I think there's the conversation is out there, and I think that people are aware that diversity needs to be championed, specifically in the world of technology. I don't think that the actions necessarily follow all the conversations that are being had, but people are aware. And I think that there's some fantastic companies out there that are championing diversity and that are putting their best foot forward and that are looking to women and people of color to become a part of their teams and to, you know, pursue STEM careers. But I think that there's still a lot of work that needs to be done.
I'm talking with Melissa Doval. She's the CEO of the South Florida-based facial recognition technology company, Kairos. The House Committee on Oversight and Reform, as I mentioned before, is holding their second of multiple hearings today on the use of facial recognition technology. And there are concerns about the tech, about privacy, and of course about racial bias, you know, when it comes to this technology. As we just heard, some of the old tech can't even see brown or black people. Melissa, another highly contentious aspect of the technology is, of course, how the data is collected. IBM got into trouble several months ago for scrubbing photos from the social media site Flickr, so they can use it to improve their facial recognition technology. Can you speak to what scrubbing means, and of course, just talk to the concerns that people have about how their photos from any social media site might be used?
Yes. So you need to be very careful when you put photos on social media sites and when you click off on that TNC checkbox, because a lot of these social media sites can then take your data and your picture and use it to train their models and their algorithms. And Flickr is a public photo sharing site. And IBM went ahead and used the photos that were on that site to train their algorithm for facial recognition. And you know, they did it with good intentions because they were trying to feed diverse data into their model in order to better perform in a diversity test. So, you know, their intentions were good. Maybe the methods that they took weren't exactly probably the right path. And so what we of Kairos have done is that we've procured our data through proper channels, you know, companies and agencies that are actually go out and seek individuals who are willing to give their data for these kind of studies, and who properly identify themselves and their diversity and their age and their gender, and so that when the data comes to us, it's properly identified and labeled, and when we're feeding it to our algorithm, we are actually feeding our algorithm proper information so that that algorithm is then being properly trained.
And you know, when you talk about social media sites and the rights of you know the photos or anything you put on those sites, again, as you said, there's that the TNC, right? It's a consent.
Correct.
You're allowing people, maybe you are or not, but you have to read the fine print to know whether or not you're allowing your information and your photos to be able to be used that way. You said though, Kairos is going about it differently and getting this information for its algorithm through certain sources that are consenting to this. Is there enough paid for data sets that you can use? Is there enough information out there like that, you know, to be able to have accurate algorithms?
It's out there. It's very difficult to come by and expensive, but it's out there. And I think as time continues to pass, more and more data becomes available. You know, the world is moving to the economy of data. All of this is now possible because of data and because it's so readily available. And as we, you know, move forward, it's going to become more and more readily available and accessible. And so we're hoping that in the next, you know, 3 to 5 years, the amount of data is going to increase significantly, and these algorithms will just continue to improve. I mean, at this point, even, you know, we get 99.97% accuracy. So what we're talking about here is 0.03% improvement at this point.
So another concern people have about the technology is use by the government, use by police forces. Police departments have been using this, you know, in some departments for a number of years, though, right? I mean, this isn't new for them either.
It's not. The problem with facial recognition in the past is that it didn't work very well. It was slow, it was bulky. They would set it to run, and it would take hours or days for it to go through a database and possibly maybe get a match, and that match may not have been very accurate. The models that we're working with right now are very efficient, very fast, and quite possibly very, very accurate. And so this is now a very, very, you know, accurate tool that law enforcement can have at their fingertips. The problem then comes is, you know, how are they using it, and you know, what are they using it for? There's a big conversation out there when it comes to ethics and AI, and how human beings are then taking the information that they're garnishing from AI and how they're implementing it and using it in real world situations. And there's a bit of a dichotomy because it's either how human beings are feeding or creating the AI or how they're taking the information. For example, in self-driving cars, you program a self-driving car to either make a decision to hurt a pedestrian or hurt a passenger. And there's an inherent ethical decision you have to make there when you're creating a self-driving car, right? And then when you are using AI and facial recognition through law enforcement, then you as a human being have to make a decision about what you do with those results. But there's still a level of human interaction between getting results from a facial recognition search and then what you do with those results.
Right. Do you know of any South Florida agencies, governments, law enforcement that are using it or have requested it?
None that I know of at this point.
Is it something that the company is Kairos looking at, you know, working with law enforcement agencies or governments in you know, getting the technology to them? Is that a potential customer?
No, we don't work with law enforcement.
I did want to ask you about, we have to note Kairos' founder and former CEO, Brian Brackeen. Apologies if I'm not saying that right. He was an outspoken advocate surrounding the issues of racial bias in facial recognition technology. My understanding is that he was pushed out of the company for issues surrounding his communication with shareholders and investors. Is that correct?
We just decided to go in a different direction with the company.
And he had a lawsuit, or does he still have a lawsuit with Kairos?
That's not been settled, actually.
Okay. Where do you see the future of facial recognition technology? I mean, you know, you mentioned earlier, there are other parts of the world where governments are using this extensively. Is the U.S. far behind?
Yeah, so the U.S. is way far behind anything that China is doing at this moment. However, I think that in the next 10 or 15 years, you're going to see facial recognition is going to become a very, very normal part of our lives. I remember when Facebook first came to be, most folks were very skeptical about Facebook and didn't want to set up a profile on Facebook. And everybody was like, oh, that's Big Brother looking at you. And look at the amount of people that have now signed up for Facebook. And it's a very normal part of our lives. With the advent of Face ID on the iPhones, facial recognition has now become a very normal part of our lives, whether we realize it or not. And as we move forward in, you know, into biometrics, facial recognition, it's the easiest and the least in, you know, intrusive form of biometrics. And it's the most secure way for us to keep our financial transactions and our transactions and our interactions secure. And so that's going to be the future of how we transact human to human or business to business.
But is it technology? The other thing too is this. I remember when the iPhone X came out, I think, you know, they were talking about using facial your face to open it. Mm-hmm. And that it's unhackable. And yet then somebody was claiming they hacked it. Is this technology unhackable? Do you think once it's matured enough that it's unhackable, or that's really just going to be another problem?
I think every technology is hackable. There's always going to be somebody that finds a way to hack it. We are working on anti-spoofing ways to make sure that you can't hack facial recognition. But, you know, fingerprints should have been unhackable. People have found ways to hack it. There's always going to be some way around it. And that's why you need to be very careful when using some kind of sign-on, that you use dual factor or triple factor authentication. But the way the world is moving, people are really smart and really efficient and have ways of moving around any kind of security function that you might set. But that being said, some of the most secure ways is biometrics.
And yes, as you said, you know, always have that 2-3-tier system of getting into your accounts, getting into your, you know, into your files, et cetera, your computer.
Correct.
So real quickly, I wanted to finish with this is, you know, you talk about a lot of people have kind of already bought into it. I mean, when it comes to Facebook, they bought into the idea. There is always that complaint about privacy. And again, what happens to our data. But do you think that we just bought into this idea that technology is always watching us? Somebody's always watching us.
I think that all of this new technology is always met with an initial resistance. And then we kind of get used to it and complacent and we move on with our lives. And then a new technology comes up and we become resistant to it. And then we continue to move on because we realize the ease and the efficiency that it creates around us. And the cost benefit of it doesn't necessarily make sense. So you're going to see this. The same thing is going to happen with facial recognition. There's going to be an initial apprehension towards it when it starts to become very, very, you know, prevalent in our society. And then folks are going to realize that this is amazing and it's awesome and it's a really cool technology. Why did I ever not want to use this? And then people will get past the negative stuff about it.
It is like anything. Technology just keeps changing, and, well, we just adapt to it. Melissa Doval is the CEO of the South Florida-based facial recognition technology company, Kairos. Melissa, thank you so much for the time, for the information. It's great.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
And as I mentioned, there is a House Committee on Oversight and Reform holding their second of multiple hearings today on the issue of this technology and how we should move forward. Well, still to come, we know our coral reefs are in trouble. We're going to meet a group that's going to send scientists down for regular checkups of those systems and how you can get involved. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, America's Great Barrier Reef along the coast of Florida is home to more than 6,000 species, probably more. It generates about $6 billion for the state economy. But the reef is in trouble. Climate change, overfishing, poor water quality, all of these things and more continue to damage the reef, destroy it. And over the years, Florida has passed legislation for coral reef restoration efforts. But have they been enough? Starting today, OceanX begins a mission called Saving America's Great Barrier Reef. They're sending biologists who study coral reefs to do what they call real-time health checks. This will show what keeps coral reefs healthy and what makes them sick. And they're asking people, they're asking you, to follow along on social media. Dr. Vincent Parabone is the vice chairman of OceanX and a Yale scientist, and he joins me now in studio. Vincent, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Lewis, for having me.
Where did your interest for the ocean come from, by the way? Where did that start?
Well, I was born in Florida, actually born in Titusville. My first experiences of the ocean were actually swimming out here in the reefs in Miami, in Biscayne Bay and the Florida Keys. So for me, this is like a full circle to come back here and see this. My science led me in the direction of biomedical science, but I've always been interested in marine science and marine life because of my growing up here in Florida. So I was able to return to that topic later in my life and became a kind of a mixture of a neuroscientist and a marine scientist, and that's what led me to OceanX.
I would love to know your thoughts on, because from when you were a young man and swimming around and seeing the reefs that we had and where the condition they're in now, what have you seen? How has it changed?
So, I mean, I could say the last time I think I dove in Florida as a child, I would say back when, was in the 70s and the 80s, and it was magnificent. And you would get in the water, and it was like this, for me, it was putting my head below with a mask on and seeing just this rush of colors, of fish, of coral, of life. It's like this city that's going on, you know, with or without you, and you're there just to witness and observe it. And then I came back years and years later. I've traveled the world. I've dove on reefs everywhere in the world, essentially, and, you know, have watched over these 30 years a steady decline all over the world. But I have to say, to return to Florida, a few years ago, I came back and it was literally tears in my eyes to dive in the water, to look down and see how our reefs look today. And I was in Cuba very recently, less than a year ago, diving on those reefs. And although many of those reefs have also been damaged by human contact, there are parts of those reefs that are really unbelievable. And I was swimming in the Garden of the Queens in Cuba recently, and again, had that same sensation of the beauty and the grandeur of huge mounds of Elkhorn coral and fish everywhere. So coming back here and seeing it the way it is now here in Florida, for me as a Floridian, it's sad. And I think this mission is meant in a way for me, it's a coming home in a way, but it's a way to draw attention back onto the reef for Floridians, because some of this damage to the reef is a local phenomenon. There's climate change, there's a lot of pressures on the reef, but there are a lot of local pressures and pressures that we Floridians can work on.
Let me start with this. I wanted to know, tell us a little bit about OceanX and how you became a part of it.
So I was fortunate enough to do an expedition with OceanX back in 2013 when they invited me on board to study coral. Actually, we were in Solomon Islands. And I study coral proteins that we use in biomedical research. So I was lucky enough to go. And so I've kept in touch with OceanX over those years, and very recently I joined them to help, and now I've become the chairman of the organization. And I love the mission and the idea of it, which is both science, exploration, and storytelling, and helping marriage those two together to help protect the reefs.
And this project is called, as I mentioned before, Saving America's Great Barrier Reef. What's the goal? And how do you think OceanX is going about doing this?
So we came up with this idea. Since our ship, we have this enormous research vessel, the Alusha, which has plied the oceans, like I said, of the entire Earth. And I was happy when we came up the coast. We went down, the west coast of Central America, down South America to Antarctica, and we were coming up the coast, and I thought, wow, finally the vessel's going to be in Florida. And I was excited to bring this massive scientific platform to Florida and do this experiment. So we got together with a bunch of our collaborators, Woods Hole Oceanographic, Scripps Institute of Oceanography, Moat Marine Laboratory, and said, let's do a high-intensity, multidisciplinary study from one end to the other of the Florida Barrier Reef System. So we're going to start all the way down in Dry Tortuga and end all the way up in Miami Bay. We're going to get this very high-intensity snapshot of the current health of the reef. And we're using state-of-the-art microbiological technology and imaging technology to capture that information.
How long is it going to take?
It's about 2 weeks. So it's a very intensive 2 weeks. We're sitting down on the dock right now, mobbing, loading the boat up. It's a beehive of activity, people bringing equipment on and off. And then it'll be intensive diving of over 100 locations all the way from the extent, from the sort of healthier extent of the reef to the west to the less healthy extent in the east.
And it's something, as you said, you're talking about storytelling, because that's one of the keys to getting people involved. So how are you going to use that in getting us, just the regular folks, to follow along on this journey and be a part of it?
So at the heart of OceanX is exactly that concept, is that the science done alone gets to the scientific community and has impact and is important. But unless it gets out to the greater public, the public can't choose and make decisions about their lifestyles based on information they learn. So our goal is to take everything we do scientifically. And let me tell you, it's a very difficult mission to combine science and media together and take that storytelling. So we need the storytellers in the middle to tell that story. So we produce all types of short media for the internet. We produce digital media, social media. So we'll have our social media channels running at high, presenting every detail of what's going on in a way that's amenable and available to the public. So we take pride in being able to translate these complicated themes to things that people can understand.
And of course, show people, you know, what you were describing earlier, which is how so much of that beauty is disappearing.
Yeah, and it's to try to get the audience to, because the reefs tend to be hidden, it's something they don't think about. They don't see it in their daily life. And yet, it's a real treasure for the U.S. This reef is our only continental barrier reef. It's probably the fifth largest in the world. It's enormous, and it's a treasure for the U.S., and we've kind of let it go. And I think this generation, maybe more than any other generation, feels empowered to change that. And the state of Florida has begun massive projects, and I think the more the public understands what they're doing recently and what's happening, the better for the reefs.
I'm talking with Dr. Vincent Perrybone. He's the vice chairman of OceanX, a nonprofit organization exploring the ocean. And starting today, they're going to be launching this new mission. It's called Saving America's Great Barrier Reef in the Keys along Florida's coast. On its vessel, the Alusha, right? Is that
That's
how it's
correct?
The team will collect data, video, perform health checks on the coral reefs. And again, Floridians can follow along on their social media at OceanX. We'll be linked to that as well, so you can keep following them and see what they're doing. Part of this, Vincent, is you're going to have scientists doing these regular checkups. How are they going to be working? How does that, you know, is it going to be nonstop 24/7?
Yeah. So it's a beehive. Like I said, once the boat sets sail, everybody's setting up their experiments and gets going. And it's a great collaborative environment to meet people and see them working under such intense conditions, because everybody's pushing forward for the same mission. So we have a microbe group that's studying the microbiology, and we have an imaging group that's studying the imaging, and myself involved in imaging at night. We're imaging them at night with fluorescent photography to look at how that changes as well. So it's a great collaborative experience to be on board a ship. It's like almost nothing else, just the interactions, the intensity of the interactions and the scientific discourse. And there's so much passion amongst this team to help protect the reefs, and especially our Florida collaborators, Moat Marine Laboratory, have done a tremendous amount of work in studying and restoration of the reef. So we're so excited to come down and highlight that.
I mentioned it at the beginning, but we've talked about this issue many times on this program. Let me ask you, where are the biggest threats coming from and the role we play? Whether it's, you know, I'd imagine it's not something we're consciously doing, but maybe just us being here and the things we're doing is causing the damage, right?
Yeah. And, you know, there are the larger issues, the ones that are sort of seemingly intangible but are really human.
The climate change.
The climate change, yeah. For example. But the local issues are the ones we're trying to highlight while we're down here, because they're the ones I think Floridians have the most impact on. So the coral reefs have this beautiful clear water, which is the hallmark of a coral reef. We call it oligotrophic, which is the big science word for clear water. And what that just means is that there's not a lot of nutrients in the water. There's not a lot of things for all the algae to grow in. If you add nutrients and essentially add fertilizer to the water becomes a bit cloudy. And without cloudy water or with those kind of nutrients, coral doesn't do well. The light doesn't get to the coral, which it needs for growth. And that kind of pollution, that nutrification, as we call it, is one of those additional stressors and combined with climate change. So we're talking a lot about that type, pollution and overfishing of the reefs, because fish are essential to maintain the health and quality of the reef. So extensive fishing and pollution that have happened in this area that the state is now attempting to reverse. And I think you need to reverse those stressors prior to the restoration projects that MOAT is doing, not prior to, but in parallel to restoring the coral that's left and remains.
That's become a big thing in this last legislature is dealing. Well, I mean, you know, the big conversation was obviously the red tide, the blue green algae, the brown algae, and all these issues. And so the state's trying to approach that. Part of it is the economics. They know that the state, you know, our economy depends so much on this. It's huge.
It's a billion-dollar economy. And I like to think that at one point in the 70s, Florida had the highest density of dive shops in the Florida Keys. And we've let some of that business slip, a lot of that business slip. Now we have the Caribbean are full of places that people go. And those dollars are dollars that would be better spent here. And I think that although it's an enormous economy still, it could be even a greater economy. If Florida was, again, the shining example of these reefs, it would attract divers, it would attract an economy. And I think we owe it to our country to restore this reef. And if it's possible to eliminate those local stressors, while the more global ones are more difficult to deal with, and obviously we have to continue to deal with those, and obviously OceanX is very much a part of that effort, the local ones is the part that Florida and its citizens can help with. The nutrification, the runoff, all those things are intangible in some way. One of the ideas of this mission is to go in and do this sort of microbial health check to study the microbes. And just like in our human body, the microbes in the reef, these symbiotic characters that live within the coral and around the coral and help it survive. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad, just like in our gut. And when there's an imbalance of those, things go bad, as in the human gut. So we're kind of trying to do the similar experiments that they're doing in humans to understand what the correct flora should look like. And when it goes south, how things get bad for the reef.
I wanted to get your take, though, on, you know, whether it's the local governments, because they've tried to, you know, local governments have even passed laws on banning things. We look at Key West as an example. They've just passed a law banning certain types of sunscreen.
Yes.
Do you think those are effective?
Absolutely.
Is that going to be effective? Because it doesn't go into effect for another couple of years, but do you think that's...
Absolutely. They're unfortunately, these reefs, although they're robust and diverse, they're actually quite sensitive to things like that. So if you imagine you jumping in the water with suntan lotion doesn't seem to buy much, but thousands of people jumping into the water and leaking this very potent sunscreen onto coral, which are desperate for sun. And then you add to that, you know, not clear water, you add to that high in temperatures, you add that acidification, and the coral kind of gives out. And we talk a lot about coral because coral are the architects of everything. So each one of these changes, I think, is essential. And you have controls for this because when you go out to the reefs that are less close to human contact, they look better by and large, right? Now, they are still under the impact of global warming, which is, of course, a global event, but they're not under the same stresses as the ones that are local with the pollution and the chemicals and things like that. So I think every little effort that's made will have an impact, and it'll combine in a way.
So it'll have an impact, but I want to know from you, do you think we can restore them? Do you think we can go back to when you were young and you jumped in that water and you saw this incredible, like, other city that just, you know, do you think we can get back to that? Is it possible?
I really hope so. I really hope that we have to start. I always say we have to put the fire out before we bring new furniture in. You know, if we want to rebuild this environment, and I think we can do that. I think what the work that's been done here in MOAT shows that you can, on a large scale, reclaim some of those reefs and grow them back. We'll only know that once we eliminate the stressors that are there. And I think it's essential. I think it's a battle we just cannot give up on. We just can't let that go. When you've traveled the world like I have and seen reefs as they are, we want that back again here in the Florida. I guarantee everybody wants that back. We want the fish back. We want the reefs back. We should not give up hope for that.
And again, people can follow as you guys are going through the next couple of weeks of all this research. They can follow you online and see all the work you're doing right now.
Yeah, we're going to be posting live, some live, semi-live, a lot of the experiments we're doing. We're going to talk a little bit about reefs, about the Florida reef, the history and things like that in segments on our social channels. We'd love everybody to go to oceanx.com and follow us on Facebook and Instagram and all the usual channels to follow along on this. I think it's a very important study. The data from this will then go out to the management people here in Florida and help them understand the damage that's being done to the reef and how to person.
He is Dr. Vincent Barabone, again, the vice chairman of OceanX, a nonprofit organization exploring the ocean. Again, this new exploration they're doing, I should say, this new research they're doing, a mission. It's called Saving America's Great Barrier Reef, looking at the reefs here in Florida and all the way down to the Keys and what we can do to save them. Vincent, thank you so much. I appreciate the time.
My pleasure. Thank you, Lewis.
And that is the program for this Tuesday, June 4th. Well, coming up tomorrow on Sundial, the Carnival Cruise Corporation agreed to pay $20 million in fines for dumping oily waste into the ocean back in 2016. Our environment reporter Jenny Stiletovich will update us on that story and the reports of coral reefs being destroyed during the dredging of Port Miami. We'll also look into that story. Plus, do you know anyone who traveled the Camino de Santiago, the 800-kilometer trip across from France into Spain? You're going to hear a conversation we had with John Pardoe. He crossed the Camino in a wheelchair, and he made a documentary of it. Oh, and by the way, he was also a contestant on MasterChef Latino. We'll hear his story coming up. And finally, summer shorts are back at the Arts Center. 8 short plays in one performance, covering everything from boring presidents, existential crisis in the supermarket, and racial profiling. And of course, it is time now to announce our title for the Sundial Book Club for the month of June. And for this month, we're going back in time.
You just shot me!
Fired a warning shot and it hit you.
You're no cop!
Oh my God!
No problem! There is no problem! Police, homicide, you people go about your business, you finish your lunches, your breakfasts, whatever. Don't worry, lady, I'm gonna call an ambulance now on the radio in my police car. Yeah, I'll be right back.
That's a clip from the movie Miami Blues starring Alec Baldwin, based on the 1984 book Miami Blues by Charles Williford. That's the June book. Find us on Facebook. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.